Welcome to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College. We have a fairly regular guest on Health Styles, Marianne Napoli, who's the Associate Director of the Center for Medical Consumers. And we have her on periodically because she is the editor of what used to be a hard copy, now is online, reporting on various health issues that is, I think, she does one of the best jobs in the country on critically examining what some of the evidence is around various health issues and what some of the hype is, and trying to come some conclusions about whether we're an over-medicalized society and what is the right thing to do with both screening and with treatments and with self-care management. So I want to welcome Marianne Napoli back to the program today. Marianne, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and thank you for that kind introduction.
So actually, we should share with listeners your website. And it does include, if you go to the homepage, it includes some of the issues that we're going to be talking about today.
Yes. It's medicalconsumers.org. Medical Consumers is one word in plural.
.org. So on your website today, you've got several issues, and one of the ones that was of great interest to me is one around the issue of if people have advanced illness, should they have to choose between comfort care and curative care? And this is of particular interest, I think, to people who have been diagnosed with a terminal illness and may be wanting to consider hospice care, but are told that they have to give up all curative care to go on to hospice, and vice versa, that many times when they're pursuing a curative treatment, physicians and others may not be having full disclosure about some of the comfort care options. So talk to us about what you discovered with this issue.
Well, the trigger for my article was a directive of a couple of days ago from the American Society of Clinical Oncology, and that is, you know, the major organization of oncologists. And this directive may have been aimed at oncologists, the cancer specialists, but it goes beyond when you read the interview that I did with Diane Meyer, who is at Mount Sinai Center to Advance Palliative Care, and she's also
in New York City.
Here in New York, right? And she is a co-author of this directive. It's sort of like it's based on expert opinion, but when you read the paper, and I did put a link to it on my website, you see that there are seven randomized trials that support this directive, and the gist of it is they've studied, virtually all of the people studied are elderly people with terminal illness, not necessarily all cancer, but they looked at them and found that the ones that were randomly assigned to comfort care, and I guess we should define that a little bit into this talk, but were randomly assigned to comfort care, they not only had a better quality of life at the end of their lives, but they also surprisingly lived longer.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a message that's not really getting out there. There's now seven trials that have looked at that and found that this is the case. So the directive the American Society of Clinical Oncology published a couple of days ago is trying to break that trend of making people think that it's either or. You either have to accept aggressive treatment or then you're turned over to a palliative care team and you're basically giving up, which is how a lot of Americans see it. And they shouldn't have to choose, is what this paper is all about.
And actually, on Health Styles, we've interviewed before Amy Berman, who is a senior program officer at the John A. Hartford Foundation, and a nurse who discovered that she had incurable breast cancer And after being explained the by the leading oncologist in the country for this kind of breast cancer, being told that her treatment option or her course of treatment would be mastectomy, it would be aggressive chemotherapy and radiation therapy, just said, no, thank you. Her cancer had already metastasized her spine, and she chose to just do palliative care and care to try to just slow down the cancer a bit without the aggressive adverse effects. And she describes that as she has made the decision that she wants to maintain a high quality life for as long as she can, instead of undergoing all these other treatments and having the quality of her life drop dramatically and probably remain low until she dies. She wants to go for it, and she's going for it. Yeah, and she's now been living more than a year. She's active. She talks about this issue all the time. She's still working full time and traveling all over the country and trying to get the message that it's about people who have advanced illness being able to make their own decisions about treatment options, but they can't do that unless they're fully informed about those options.
Well, you know, it's pretty recent where you wouldn't have a choice. There weren't that many palliative care teams to turn to for people who are making the choice that she did, right?
Yeah.
They're relatively new.
So talk about the comfort care and what that means.
Well, the definition, I can read you the definition that the American Society of Clinical Oncology gives you in this paper. It's care focused on the relief of suffering in all its dimensions throughout the course of a patient's illness. And the doctor I interviewed for my article, who was a really admirable doctor who has been trying to promote, I mean, not trying. She is promoting pretty successfully palliative care, but she has a different definition. And what I like about her definition, and it's at the end of this article, is that she includes the family in the definition, because it really isn't just the patient who is suffering. Mm-hmm. And I think that was an important extension of the definition. What she told me that was news to me, I must say, is that on her website, which is getpalliativecare.org, and get palliative care is all run together as one word, they have a directory where people in different parts of the country can find out what hospitals in their region have palliative care teams. Mm. And that's a huge benefit, because I think people would be stumped.
Yeah. And that's on the website getpalliativecare.org.
That's right. .org, right. And that is Diane Myers, Dr. Diane Myers' team that put that together. Uh-huh. And another definition that they can read when they get to her website, which is the getpalliativecare.org. But she says she said a bunch of interesting things to me about the way people receive that either or. Medicare certainly fosters that. You know, you either get comfort care or you have to make a choice. And when you make that choice of comfort care, when you're on Medicare, have to sign away your right to any other kind of treatment. Mm-hmm. And people really don't want to give up, you know. I mean, even when they fully understand, and a lot of people don't, that what the oncologists offer you isn't going to be curative, they want to try it. They get a lot of pressure from their family members. You know, even if it's just a month more, go for it. You know, but you have to sign that away when you're on Medicare. And what is important for people to know is these new studies that show you're not saying I've got an early death awaiting me. That you do have, when you get the comfort care, the palliative care, it not only improves the quality of your remaining life, but it also prolongs life, and that's what's news about in the last couple of years,
yes.
The studies that have come out to show that.
And it's probably because when you don't have the palliative care, what you're dealing with is a lot of symptoms from the other treatments that are really debilitating. A lot of adverse effects, I think. So,
And they're not warned about it.
Yes, exactly. Now, you also have another story that relates to this, and that is about a breast cancer treatment decisional aid. Talk for a minute first what a decisional aid is.
Well, especially in cancer, but not only about cancer, there are a lot of complex decisions people have to make, and it's doubtful that many people have it explained to them. And what you really need to know is, first of all, what if I just don't have a treatment, and what are my odds of survival versus what the treatment choice is going to do for you? And what's being talked about here with this decision aid, which is called PREDICT, it's only about a very specific but very common decision women have to make when they have a breast cancer diagnosis. And here's the scenario. When you have breast cancer, your initial treatment can be one of several. It can be just a lumpectomy. It can be the breast removal, which is mastectomy, of course. And it can be a minor amount of surgery, just taking the tumor itself and then being treated with X number of weeks of radiation therapy and then variations of that. So when that is over, the woman usually has to make another decision, and that's about adjuvant therapy. And adjuvant means add-on. After your initial treatment is over, no matter which way you go, even when it's found early, you have varying risks of having a recurrence. And that depends, I say varying, on, you know, the tumor size, the stage, whether it's estrogen receptor positive. And what I think is terrific about this website is you have to know a lot of detail about your diagnosis to use this website. And it's entirely free. You type in your age, your stage, your grade of tumor, the stage of the disease, and so on. And it tells you what the advantage, first, what if you do nothing, and then how you would improve your chances of surviving longer by choosing adjuvant therapy. And I should stop myself and explain what that is. It's, as I said, it's an add-on, and it can be anything from chemotherapy to hormone therapy. And in hormone therapy, it would be tamoxifen, aromatase inhibitors, or drugs like that that you pretty much will inevitably be taking orally. Mm-hmm. And often for years. In the case of tamoxifen, it's about 5 years. Sometimes it's three. Depends. But it's a very, I thought, consumer-friendly website that was worth mentioning on my website. And it's based in the UK. And we have one in the United States, but you have to be a doctor to enter it. So the advantage of this one is not only is it better, I think, than the one than the American version, but it's more accessible because you don't have to pretend you're a doctor.
And how do you access this again?
Well, PREDICT is spelled PREDICT. Mm-hmm. Then it's predict.nhs, which is the National. initials for the National Health Service, .uk. So it's pretty, and if somebody doesn't have a pen while they're listening to this, and they got my website, it's on all these things we're discussing are on the homepage, and you can just go into my website and get right into it. And predict.nhs.uk.
And that website is www.medicalconsumers.org. It's the website for the Center for Medical Consumers.
Yes,
and we're talking with Marianne Napoli, who's the associate director of the center and does a lot of their writing about the kinds of issues that we're talking about today. So and they're available for free. You can go on. It's really a treasure trove of information about health-related issues. And sometimes there are issues that we sort of take for granted, like the next one, and that is the issue of sinusitis and antibiotics. So many people have sinus problems that become really blown up, if you will. They people get headaches, and besides the drainage, I think the headache and the pain in the sinuses sometimes becomes unbearable. And I recently had a relative who told me that whenever she has a sinusitis, she immediately starts on antibiotics. So that now sounds like bad advice, given what you've written about. Tell us about what we know about sinusitis.
It's amazingly bad advice. It has become the standard way of treating sinusitis and acute sinusitis, which is, as you said, terrible and painful. And I think people want a quick fix. It's just that the overwhelming majority of cases of acute sinusitis are viral infections, and that means there is no benefit at all to taking an antibiotic. So the trigger for this, or the basis, I guess I should say, for this article that I wrote for our website is a study where people were with acute sinusitis are randomly assigned to no treatment or amoxicillin. And the gist of this study at the end of it was that you did not get better any faster if you were in the group that got amoxicillin as compared to the people who got no treatment. And it's important to keep that in mind, that there are a lot of things like that, like this, that are what doctors and nurses call self-limiting, meaning they go away on their own whether you treat it or not. Mm. And this is a prime example. And we're never going to find out whether my suspicion is true, that a lot of sinusitis becomes chronic when we overuse antibiotics. Mm-hmm. This is just my opinion. It's not in any drug company's mm-hmm. interest to find out whether that is true, because you'd have to do a study. And, of course, we know that the drug companies do most of the studies, and they don't want to find that out. Yeah. And it's something that we should be concerned about, that overusing antibiotics is really causing a dangerous level of resistance. And I guess everybody who's listening to your show knows that by now. There's always something to be concerned about with when some study comes out with the majority got better, because it wasn't a very big study. It was 166 adults, and there was a certain amount of choosing of who gets into these trials, and usually people with more severe symptoms are probably going to be sorted out, and that was the case with this trial. So I was I happened to know from writing about this before that there are a tiny minority of people whose sinusitis is due to bacterial infections. And how do you know, was what I asked the lead doctor of this study. And she said there's no doubt that some of a minority have bacterial infections, but And they are likely to benefit and not necessarily always benefit from taking antibiotics. But she said the way you would know whether you're in that minority is if you get up to 10 days of symptoms and you're not getting any better and you feel that they're very severe, then you should go back to the doctor, call back and say, I think I might be a candidate for antibiotics because it's going on too long. And I put up in this story, because that leaves it a bit open-ended, what I just said, I think it's important for people to go to this other website I love a lot, which is the NNT.com. And what they
NNT as in Nancy.
Yes,
Nancy.
As in number needed to treat.
Right. Okay.
And if they go to the sinusitis, they've done lots of different ailments that you want to know what your chances of benefiting from it are. This is such a great website because it shows in very easy terms, you know, how many people will benefit from taking antibiotic, how many people will be harmed, and then they have a discussion at the end that I wanted to lead my readers to, that even they're saying doctors have a very hard time determining which people have bacterial infection, and keep in mind they're a tiny minority because most are viral. But they go into a discussion at the end about how you can have this test and that test, and X-rays don't do any good, and how difficult it is for doctors to determine whether it's viral or bacterial.
And by the way, you may be seeing a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner, and the same applies in terms
yes,
of your
I'm
primary
sorry,
care.
I
That's
keep
all right.
Forgetting that.
That's all right. And so the takeaway here, I think, is that you don't want to be taking antibiotics unless, again, 10 minutes you've been or 10 days you've been on this with this sinusitis, and it's still the symptoms have not abated.
Yes,
so that's really good. And the website for the number to treat is thennt.com.
Yes, yeah, all written out nnt.com, and that takes you to their homepage. I it was too long to give the link to the sinusitis one, but it's easy to find the sinusitis section, and if you can't, you just go to my article about it, and you'd get directly to the right one from the link in at the end of my article about sinusitis.
Now, Marianne, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to just quickly have you comment on the latest information about bone density testing.
Yeah.
You have been somebody who has long argued that bone density testing was developed to sell a pill. So what's the latest recommendation? What's your take on it?
Well, first of all, we got a lot of misinformation starting about 15 or so years ago that we should have bone density testing when menopause is over. And the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force, which I think is one of the best on screening guidelines, says, I think they had kind of wimpy or didn't get into it fast enough, but their guidelines say do not start to have your bone density tested with DECA or whatever you're going for it. That's an acronym, and I'm sure most women are familiar with that by now, but if they're over 50 anyway, but to wait until you're 60. And the reason that they are saying that is because they have finally become aware, they, doctors who write guidelines, that once you start screening women, you are sending them a goodly portion of them on to have to go on long-term drug therapy, and usually it's a bisphosphonate like Fosamax or Boniva and so on. And so I want to start with the latest guidelines of when you should start, when you have absolutely no symptoms, bone symptoms, and you're 65 is when you should start. And there are some exceptions, like women that have been on steroid drugs and so on. But for the vast majority of us, you don't have to start till 65. And what they found in this new study that I've reported on is that when you they followed women for 10 who had normal bone density, and this was in the New England Journal of Medicine last month, when they followed 5,000 women who were 67 or older who had normal bone density at the hip and no history of hip or spinal fracture or osteoporosis treatment. They followed them. In other words, nothing was done to these women. They either had normal or osteopenia, which is almost having osteoporosis. And what was interesting about this study, no treatment done, was to find that the majority of them were fine 15 years later, 10 to 15 years later. So that is showing us rather late, I think, is that we've been screened too much.
Yes, yes. And it's a really important issue. I'm sorry, we're out of time, but it's a really important issue, and you have had a long track record of trying to raise awareness among women about think twice before you do some of these screening tests. Mm-hmm. And let's tell people to go to your website. Do you want to give that again, and they can read more about this issue?
Right, www.medicalconsumers.org. And all the articles we've been talking about are the links are on the homepage.
And there are all kinds of other articles up there and information about a variety of issues that are issues that many of us are dealing with every day. And so, Marianne, you're doing a really great service to the community by the fine work that you do, and I really appreciate you. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you for having me on the radio show.
And bye-bye. Marianne Napoli, again, is the Associate Director for the Center for Medical Consumers. And again, their website is www.medicalconsumers.org. You've been listening to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. That's centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you.